Hi, and welcome to The Air Show. I'm Brian Summers, and I write The Airline Observer, a newsletter for airline executives focused on the commercial aspects of the business.
I'm John Ostrower. I'm editor-in-chief of The Air Current, and I chase after airplanes professionally.
And I'm Brett Snyder. You probably know me as the author of Cranky Flyer.
And here we are, our first episode of our brand new podcast. This is a podcast where we talk about what goes on in the business of the sky.
This has been an idea that we've had for a bit now, and it's finally come together. And bringing our respective publications, experience, expertise all together to professionally talk about the things that we talk about offline, online.
Yeah.
So that's The Air Show. We've known each other for a bunch of years, and I figured a good place to start is like, let's introduce ourselves. Some people know us individually in our individual reporting and our publications, but this is a whole new thing that we're doing together. And so I figured let's just break the ice. Brian?
So I'm Brian Summers. I've been covering the beat for about a dozen years. It's the greatest thing. I love the industry so very much. I didn't get my start covering airlines. I started off covering sports. I was an expert in NASCAR for a little bit. And so when I started covering the airline beat and I started taking it a little bit more seriously and knowing the players, I realized that it might make sense to cover it just a little like sports. So it means that, you know, on my newsletter, The Airline Observer, I can often tell you who's up, who's down, who inspires their teams, who's mocked by them. I can also tell you, you know, who's going to get a raise or who might be about to be fired by their board. I think a lot of reporters tend to be too polite and don't want to point out some gross idiocy that happens sometimes in the industry. So I like to have a bit of a critical eye. I met these two guys after I started on the beat, although, John, I knew you well before because you may not know this, but I was covering other things and I really wanted to get into airlines. And so I applied for your old job at Flight Global. And in my cover letter, I said, I want to be the next John Ostrower. And at the time, I didn't really know you, so I did not know how naive that was, because nobody can be the next John Ostrower.
Well, hold on. I think no one could be the next John Ostrower because no one can grow that beard. I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
The audience can't see the beard.
No, but they've seen the beard. They've seen the beard.
We're going to be breaking down the nuances of the airline business here on The Air Show.
All sports. all the time. No, we're not even going to talk about NASCAR. Well, I started in this industry when I was like 2 years old, I think, and I have no idea why. Like, there was no connection at all. But for some reason, the bug just bit me. But it's weird because, you know, everyone's like, oh, I want to fly planes or all that. I had none of that. I just love the business of the industry, the networks, the complexity of it, to the point, like, when I was a kid, I made my parents take me to LAX and I would just run around at each terminal, jump out and collect timetables. And then I would like plan routings and force my family to plan trips, which they still hold against me to this day. But, you know, that's kind of where I came from. And even I actually became a travel agent when I was 12 years old, which is ridiculous. And then during college, I had interned for America West for a couple of years there. And so afterwards, I went full time as a pricing analyst. And I will say my professor at the time, who I think many people know, Daryl Jenkins at GW, was like, why would you go to this random small airline out there that's, you know, it makes no sense. Sure enough, it was probably the best education I could have ever had. You know, you have two of the management team currently running two of the big four. You have a pretty amazing group of people with nothing to lose at that airline. So it was the best education I could have had. And then I left. I went to business school, briefly worked for United in the throes of bankruptcy, and finally actually escaped working for airlines in 2005. And then I started writing in 2006 about the business of the airline industry. And the focus was on the commercial side. And it was trying to translate a lot of airline speak into English so regular people could understand it. But, you know, network revenue, marketing. But then also in 2009, I started Cranky Concierge as an agency. And so that's really given me a lot more insight into the sales distribution world as well. So that's kind of where I go. And, you know, we talk about how we met. Brian, I don't remember when we first met. Was there like a moment? I mean, it was, you were covering the industry. We were both local. It was probably some event we met at.
Yeah, you know, my first job in aviation was covering LAX and Long Beach airports for a chain of newspapers in Southern California. The most dysfunctional place ever, LAX. And I think I needed somebody to explain to me how everything worked. And you were right nearby in Long Beach. So I'm sure we got together then, probably toured some airplanes as well.
And Ostrower, I mean, I don't remember when we first met either, because we both went to GW, but you were well after me.
Yeah, I think it was Daryl Jenkins, actually. That was sort of like weirdly facilitated the connection, because I heard about this Brett Snyder guy during my years at GW, the guy who started a travel agency when he was, you know,
yeah,
when he was like a prepubescent. Daryl Jenkins is aviation Yoda.
Are you saying he's like 300 years old?
I'm saying he has the wisdom.
Oh, okay.
The wisdom of aviation Yoda. So Daryl, by experience, was instrumental in deregulating the U.S. airline industry back in the 70s and 80s. And he worked through with a bunch of management teams as a consultant and became a professor at our alma mater, George Washington University, and to this day is responsible for being the professor of the single class in aviation that I have under my belt, and really cultivated my very much pre-existing love of aviation, all things that fly, and has been a mentor to so many of us in this industry.
So we met somehow through that.
Somehow through that. I think, and Brian, I think I met you when I was first at the Journal, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I was probably at Aviation Week.
Yes.
At that time.
That's right.
I think we had an epic time at the IATA AGM in Miami.
Oh my God. Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah, that was my first AGM. Because I mean, I was covering metal, not airlines. So I stumbled my way into this. I mean, I've always loved the things that fly. I have such a vivid memory of like walking down the jetway when I was 4 or 5 and just this incredible thrill of walking onto a metal tube that would hurtle me through the air and get me to another place in the world. And I could watch the sky while it was all happening, which is an amazing thing when you're a little kid. I started covering aviation officially in 2007. It was genuinely an accident and a total twist of fate that got me into this. So I launched a blog, and actually 17 years ago next week, just to even say that out loud is kind of crazy. I'd been a politically focused major with my single aviation class with Daryl Jenkins. And effectively, I wanted to start a blog in my free time. And so I wanted to take what I learned and when I was doing my day job in government. Brian talked about covering it from a sports perspective. I wanted to cover it from a political campaign reporting perspective and covering aircraft development that way. And so this experiment in free time ended up having me stumble my way into covering the development of the 787 for a blog that became known as Flight Blogger. And it was a crazy 2007 because the program at that point was really struggling. And just a few months after I started, Flight Global acquired Flight Blogger. And then I spent the next 4.5 years learning about aviation and effectively saying yes to every single possible opportunity to go anywhere in the world to learn about this stuff for, you know, the next, you know, almost 5 years with this incredible group of passionate aviation journalists. And, you know, it's, I think it's one thing to be a journalist who covers aviation. I think it's another thing to be an aviation journalist where you put the aviation first. And that's the thing that's kind of followed me through my career here. And so, you know, I joined the Wall Street Journal in 2012, continuing to cover Boeing, and I got to see a newspaper in action. And it was an amazing, amazing set of you know, 4.5 years there. And we covered the grounding of the 787. We covered the disappearance of MH370, the downing of MH17. Just an enormous number of aviation stories that really shaped my understanding of aviation safety and operations and how all of this industry works, but also seeing big media up close. So from there, I went to CNN, had a brief stint as aviation editor at the network. And after a year and a half there, I was laid off, which in turn gave me the greatest opportunity of my career to launch the Air Current and try my hand at launching a new type of aviation reporting that engineered out all the things I saw not working in the broader media. And so now I get to work with the finest aviation journalists anywhere and wake up every day getting to chase airplanes. You know, what more could a guy ask for?
I want to put this out. The three of us really can complement each other well, which is why we ended up coming together to do this. So John, obviously, the aircraft background, safety, a lot of that as well. Not something that I'm as familiar with. I certainly turn to the air current when I'm looking for this kind of information. And I always am looking at the commercial side of the industry, much more of a domestic and Canada focus. And, you know, a lot of it based on my experience and, you know, things that are going on every day with my business and things like that. And then Brian, you coming at this also on the commercial side, but I think you do a much better job as a higher level as an observer, go figure, as an observer.
It's right there in the name.
and also a lot more international as well and really interesting stuff. So, you know, here we are.
If you guys are coming to the Air Current to read about metal, I go to you guys to read about airlines. And I think collectively we can be a resource to the broader industry.
This is going to be a weekly podcast focused on the business of the industry. We expect that the people who will want to listen to us work in airlines, work in aerospace, or work for the vendors that sell to airlines or OEMs. We're really going to drill deep into what's happening, why decisions are made, and we're going to have a pretty critical eye. There are a lot of people who cover this industry that are fans of the industry. You know that we all love airplanes, but if something isn't going right at an airline or an OEM, we're going to point it out and we're going to explain why.
Sometimes all three of us will be here. Sometimes it'll be two of us, depending on what the topic is and who's going to be able to best speak to it. We don't want to have too crowded of a house, but, you know, on occasion, maybe we'll have some guests over time. But really, the point is for us to talk through a lot of the work that's been done by us to dive into things on our own and come together and have these debates and discussions in front of everyone else.
We all love this industry. And I think our passion is what guides us here. I think one of the things that happens when you really love something is you want to hold it accountable and you want to learn more about it and you want to talk about it and then have those tough conversations. And that's what we want to do here. We want to really kind of go deeper and really begin to dissect this thing that we love so much, because ultimately we want to see it do well. We want to see it thrive, and we want to see all the people that benefit from it, whether you're the traveling public or those that work in it, enjoy it and prosper from it.
And we're interested in what you think. If you want to get in touch with us, we have a website. It's theairshowpodcast.com. You can figure out how to contact us there if you have comments or suggestions, or if you're interested in sponsoring the show. And speaking of that,
we're all lucky enough to spend a lot of time on airplanes, but we just really want to know when we're up there, our in-flight internet is just going to work.
Yeah, you're exactly right, John. You know, there used to be this mentality that if you connected people most of the time on most routes, it was enough. But, you know, I'm going to Brussels for the Airlines for Europe annual meeting. And I have to tell you, I can't handle any gaps in coverage. I've got work to do. I've got Instagram to look at. And I need to be connected all the time, not just some of the time. And that includes, you know, even a polar route to Asia.
And that's why Intelsat is rolling out its electronically steered array antenna, which gives coverage around the globe. It's only 3 inches tall. It's a little guy. And connects to satellites both in geosynchronous and low Earth orbits.
Brett, I just want it to work.
And that it does. They've already done trials up above the Arctic Circle, and it's working.
Great, but who has it on board?
Well, nobody yet, but Alaska, Air Canada, American, and Aerolíneas Argentinas will all have installations starting later this year.
Do you guys remember when Aerolíneas actually used to advertise having fax machines on board?
Wasn't even that long ago. Staying connected anytime, anywhere is more important than ever. Intelsat leads the way with a multi-orbit network and industry-leading antenna technology that delivers nonstop in-flight connectivity everywhere airlines fly.
One of the things is we were thinking about this first episode where we wanted to reflect on, because I think feel like it's a good opportunity to take a step back. Like, okay, we're recording this on March 13th, 2024. March 13th, 2020 was a different world than the one we're sitting in today. Literally, the world was collapsing. The NBA was canceling its schedule. Events were being canceled. The pandemic was really starting to take hold and really was spreading all over the world it was going to be a thing, right? And it was massively disrupting everything that was going on in the world and our day-to-day lives. And there were many days that I can remember through that whole process where we felt like, or I certainly felt like, I hope there's going to be an industry on the other side of this to talk about. And that was a really scary thing because, you know, and on March 13th, 2020, you weren't really totally sure what was going to be on the other side of this.
Yeah, John, but if you remember at the time, a lot of airline people were in denial. And so, you know, 4 years later, what I remember best about March 2020 was that that was when Scott Kirby, United CEO, asserted himself. He was president at the time, but he was essentially CEO. He asserted himself as the voice that we needed to listen to in the airline industry, because he got up there at the JP Morgan conference when everybody, all his competitors said, this is not going to be a big deal. We're not worried. All that happy talk that I just don't care for as a journalist. And he said, everyone, you don't know how bad this is going to be. And I think he said that they were planning for revenues to be down, you know, 70%+. And it ended up being worse than that. But there are a lot of people that cover this industry, that are involved in this industry, that remember exactly what happened that month. When the competition was just like, it's business as usual. We don't have to worry about this. It's going to be, you know, a couple months or even a couple of weeks. And you fast forward, you know, 4 years later, and, you know, Scott Kirby has a big ego and he talks about how great he is a lot. But I actually think he's pretty great. And he talks about how he used this period during the pandemic to essentially, you know, reassert, to reset United and make it into what is now probably the world's largest airline by ASMs. So the Delta people will tell us that it's not as profitable as Delta. I think that may change eventually. But just as importantly, because I, you know, I focus on who's up and who's down, you know, Scott Kirby has built a juggernaut at United. He doesn't have all the airplanes that he wants. He doesn't have the network completely the way he wants it. But, you know, there was a real reset in U.S. airlines after the pandemic, and we see United on the ascent. We see ULCCs struggling quite a bit. We see JetBlue in just very bad shape. And, you know, through the benefit of hindsight, we can see, you know, just how much the pandemic reset the U.S. airline industry. Except amazingly, Delta is still on top, and they'll tell you that all the time.
When you talk about what Scott said in 2020, it was pretty remarkable, because I think there was this sense, and I guess I'm probably the only one here who actually worked at an airline. Well, I am the only one here who worked at an airline during 9/11. And there was this sense that nothing that bad could ever happen to this industry again, at least from a U.S. perspective, right? The shock of what happened then and the just complete disappearance of revenues and everything else was so great that there was this idea that, man, it couldn't happen again. And so, you know, for Scott, who, of course, was also working in an airline at 9/11, for him to be able to get beyond that core belief, I think, that a lot of people had, says even more than if it was someone who'd come from the outside and hadn't gone through that in the same way. But it really did give them a head start on how do we manage through the pandemic. Because I think for United, they were fairly clear-eyed that they were going to come out of it one way or another. How do they get there? And they did. They remade a lot of the network. They did a lot, right? And you can really divide companies based on what they did during the pandemic. United may have gotten a head start, but I think other airlines still took real advantage. I mean, if you look at Delta, right? They accelerated their airport projects in LA and New York and said, we're going to just invest and do this and not worry about spending that money early and all that. We need to do this because when we come out the other side, we're going to have an advantage. They kept investing in Boston. They've, you know, still are in Seattle, like places that you might have given up on if you weren't worried about strategy. And you could look at Southwest, said, we're going to just open up every new city we have on our plan for the next 20 years or something. It was a strategic effort. It was, look, we've got to go for it because there will be another side. And then I think you have the other airlines that didn't do that.
Well, you had JetBlue deciding that they had not been able to get gates at Los Angeles for however many years, and that the pandemic was going to be a perfect time to shift the focus city from Long Beach to Los Angeles. And I think we all know it has not gone very well. I live here in LA. JetBlue is just an afterthought here. And I think that they could have used the planes elsewhere.
They could have. And, you know, what did they do during the pandemic? They tried Raleigh, Durham briefly and Philly. Remember the Philly, Florida stuff? And like, it wasn't really a strategic effort. It was just, how do we do random things and hopefully it'll work out in the end? I mean, we will have to do a deeper dive into JetBlue at some point because there's a lost several years at that airline. But that was one. The other one is American too, though. I mean, I find it so interesting with American that, you know, what did they do? I mean, Doug Parker did what he is good at. He went to Washington, which is the same thing he did in 9/11. It's the same thing he did then.
And begged for money.
And begged for money. And it worked. He's very good at it. It was very good and helpful. But that was sort of American strategy, was let's just keep ourselves afloat. And you think about what they did during the pandemic. I mean, they retired a bunch of airplanes, which felt like not very forward thinking. And they'll say that they're very happy that they did that. But man, there's a lot they could be doing with those airplanes right now, low ownership costs, that they just don't have those options anymore. And, you know, then they did little things like, okay, we're going to try Austin or whatever, which didn't work either. But, you know, I kind of see both of those as similar. They had some big swings like the Northeast Alliance between American and JetBlue. Nothing to really show for that now. But, you know, some airlines kind of just took their destiny into their own hands and others did not.
Yeah, I think one of the big takeaways from the entire pandemic in that early phase in 2020 was really that it showed who was ultimately resilient and ready for a crisis. Because the crises always come, right?
A crisis, and so, but not
a crisis.
Nothing to this magnitude that we've ever seen.
Well, no, I actually, I half agree with that. I think that crises of medium-sized magnitude or major, I mean, 9/11 looks medium-sized by comparison, right? On a global scale. But when you think about this, there's no way you can prepare for something like this. But I think a lot of what we saw and a lot of the resilience that we see coming to the other side of this, whether it's on the metal side with Boeing and Airbus or an Embraer, or even on the airlines globally, whether it's Singapore Airlines or Lufthansa, what we're talking about is how these institutions worked with either their sponsored governments, whether it's Lufthansa in Germany, whether it's Airbus in the broader EU and their suppliers, about how they came through it from a point of resiliency. And Boeing at that point was still in the MAX grounding. And they were building airplanes and they were racking up a massive inventory through 2019. And only at the very end of 2019 did they say, hey, we're going to stop building 42 of these things per month. And we're going to start just holding on to that inventory, but we're not going to build any more. Fast forward 2 months, they were saying, oh, well, the fundamentals of the airline industry are solid. It's going to be okay. MAX comes back. These airplanes are going to get delivered. Well, we head into a singular event of the pandemic, and Boeing and Spirit AeroSystems, which had to lay off huge numbers of people, Boeing as well, largely a function of a decision that said we weren't going to take copious amounts of government money meant to preserve the aerospace industry. They said we don't want that. They didn't want the government having a stake in Boeing to help with anything. And so, whereas in Europe it was almost the exact opposite, where Airbus was with the very much the help of European governments, directly supporting suppliers, industrial policy that was geared around resilience and holding on to the workforce. And so, you know, here we are 4 years later, and I think you see the fruits of that those efforts with respect to where we are with Boeing today. I mean, certainly we are in the middle of a significant crisis at Boeing that continues after January 5th with the very violent loss of a door plug on Alaska Airlines 1282. And so we've seen this play out. But again, COVID wasn't the cause of the issues that we find ourselves in today. It revealed issues that were pre-existing and accelerated those issues. And so that, you know, the tide goes out, the famous Warren Buffett, the tide goes out and you see who's been swimming naked. And so that's where we are today. And so, you know, when we think about Boeing and what comes next for the company and the supply chain, right now they are unraveling decades of bad decision-making that prioritized more short-term metrics around their strategy. And so whether it was selling off Spirit in the first place that created in 2005 and a decision to deliberately fracture its workforce, whether in the factory or its engineers, or how it was spending its money in terms of stock buybacks rather than investing back in itself to have a rainy day fund. So all of these things are where, you know, one of the two major aircraft manufacturers in the world for large airplanes finds itself today. And I think that's going to define a lot of where we go forward. Certainly, we can talk about United and American. United is the largest customer in the world for 787s now. And, you know, it was American's deal back in 2011 that caused the MAX to exist at all. So as we kind of step back from this, I think it's really important to look at the pandemic as a moment of effectively clarity that showed who was ready for a crisis and who wasn't.
Yeah. And that's really what this is all about is, you know, you can link a lot of these things together, right? And you can say, for example, United's foresight that this industry is going to come back and ability to place these orders early, you know, in a world now where delivery positions are at a premium, if you can find them at all, you know, that was directly out of United's clear-eyed vision of where they thought this was going to go and willing to act decisively.
Like, yeah. Brett, you know, it's funny. I interviewed Scott Kirby last year and I asked him kind of a broad question about why he bought all these airplanes. The most obvious reason is to use them. But he also said, you know, he had a theory that there were only going to be so many delivery slots. And if he sat on so many of them, hundreds of them, then there wouldn't be so many airplanes for his competitors.
And he's not wrong. It's a strategy. As long as you have the financial flexibility to be able to do those kind of things, then, you know, it's a good strategy. And that's one thing that maybe when we talk about American, I mean, they haven't had the financial flexibility since that huge order coming out of bankruptcy before the Airways merger. You know, they've been saddled with pretty high debt and they haven't had the ability to do those things. So is it strategy or is it just inability to implement the best strategy? You know, what is it? And we'll talk about all these things.
I think you hit the nail on the head, which is that the airline industry is not a green field oasis for harvesting. I think the airline industry is full of constraints and it's full of challenges that require you to effectively operate a strategy that recognizes the fact that you can't do all the things that you want. You're not going to get the number of airplanes that you want. You're not going to get the gates that you want. No one's building, you know, new runways for the most part. I mean, there hasn't been a new runway built in the US in a while, and certainly not an all new airport. So I think that operating within these constraints and also recognizing where the green fields are, right? You know with the incredible growth in India, and we could spend an entire episode talking about China, but the dynamics in China in terms of where the growth is and who's taking airplanes and why they're taking them.
I thought the green fields were in El Paso and Tallahassee. That's what I
think. Well, that's another episode. Look, we can do this all day forever, and we will. But for now, we should probably cut ourselves off and wrap up this episode. What do you think, Brian?
No, I think that's a terrible idea. Let's go for another hour.
Okay.
You've been listening to The Air Show, our very first episode of this podcast. We're thrilled to have you here. We have a lot more planned for you, and we're really excited that this podcast, which we've been thinking about for a long, long time, is up and running. Thank you for joining us. And remember, if you have suggestions or questions for us, or you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, go to our website, theairshowpodcast.com, to get in touch. Thanks to our launch sponsor, Intelsat. The Air Show podcast is produced and edited by Sarah Fay. Our theme music is by Joshua Mosher. Jennifer Swadek mixed this episode. I'm Brian Summers.
I'm John Ostrower.
And I'm Brett Snyder.
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.